Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm your host, journalist Holly Rubinstein, and here each week I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list, we'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. How are you doing, everyone? How has your week been? I hope that you're all keeping well. Here in England, it feels like summer's finally arrived, which has been glorious. So nice to spend a bit of time outside. So good for the soul. And today was actually meant to be my season 9 finale. But as you might have seen on my Instagram, after 4 years of trying to manifest the wonderful Joanna Lumley as a podcast guest, she is finally joining me on the podcast in a few weeks' time. I'm so excited. This means that you'll get today's brilliant episode, and then the next couple of weeks we'll be revisiting a couple of my all-time favourite episodes from the archives, now that we've got over 100 to pick from. And then on June 20th, put it in the diary, we're going to be joined for a whole hour by Dame Joanna Lumley. And let me tell you, it is everything I'd hoped for and more. Okay, on to today's extraordinary guest, another guest that was everything I'd hoped for and more. Megan Hine is a survivalist and wilderness guide who has carved her path in the fiercely competitive world of adventure travel, producing some of the biggest adventure and survival shows on TV around the world. Her big TV break came working alongside Bear Grylls on his hit show Man vs. Wild. And from there, her career has absolutely flourished. She's led talent and film crews in the world's toughest environments for over 20 years. A seasoned adventurer, Megan has an insatiable hunger for exploration. Armed with her unwavering spirit and an arsenal of survival skills, she's also led expeditions around the world from the arid deserts of the Sahara to the icy tundras of the Arctic. She has this remarkable ability to adapt to the harshest conditions and think on her feet, which has earned her the admiration of both novice adventurers and seasoned experts alike. It's why all the top people turn to Megan to help them make their adventure dreams come true. Interestingly, Megan is also a qualified resilience coach and has a degree in psychology. And she has a real fascination with the psychology of survival, which she uses to help clients overcome mental health struggles. And many of these techniques feature in her best-selling book, Mind of a Survivor, which we talk about today. And I found it really interesting, this part of our conversation, about how to apply techniques that you would only really encounter when you're in a survival environment, but how they can then be adapted to real life everyday scenarios. So fasten your seatbelts and get ready to embark on an unforgettable journey with us today, full of heart-stopping adventure, invaluable life lessons, and the transformative power of travel. From Panama to Tibet, New Zealand to Mongolia, let's get started. Megan Hine, welcome to the Travel Diaries. It's great to see you today. I caught you in a rare moment here in the UK. How are you?
I'm so good. I'm so excited to come and join you. Thanks so much for the invite.
Oh, you're so welcome. And you're just back from Panama?
Yes, yeah, I've just had the most crazy location scout for a TV show. I spent 4 days in Malaysia and then went from Malaysia over to Panama for a week looking for
just that quick hop.
Oh my goodness, like the jet lag was insane. So I'm not sure what time zone I'm on right now.
Tell me about Panama.
Oh, Panama's incredible. It's somewhere that I've worked a lot. So I've been working as an outdoor instructor and guide since the age of 17. And I now mostly do TV safety work and producing, which I've been doing full time for the past 15 years in some really cool locations around the globe. But Panama, I was out there looking for locations for a new big adventure show. Which is super exciting, actually. It's a new format. Love it when you get a new format in because creative slate is clean.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. But Panama, we're looking for like jungle islands. So that ultimate desert island. I filmed out there a lot around the Pearl Islands.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just incredible. And there's like saltwater crocodiles, like these things are massive, and mangroves and all of it. It's just beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
So are the Pearl Islands a place that you would like go on holiday to, or are they super remote, only kind of used for jungle type filming?
Yes, I don't know. The Pearl Islands are just beautiful. They're a holiday destination in the north. So they're an archipelago. So up in the north, the locals from Panama City will pop over for the weekends. But the further south you go, the more kind of remote and wild these places are. And there's some incredible wildlife down there. You've got like the leatherback turtles are in at the moment, and saltwater crocodiles, and all sorts of really cool bird life and things down there. So that tends to not be so much of a holiday destination that far south.
How interesting though to know that you could visit in the north. That sounds like a kind of, is it like a Maldivesy type vibe?
It is, yeah. The sandflies are a lot worse than the Maldives.
The sandflies,
And I was filming in the Maldives last year, actually, for a big Indian show. We had a big Bollywood star that came in, and we set up him up like a big like adventure journey through the Maldives. And I realized, because we were working behind the scenes around the Maldives, I realized like how man-made they are, whereas the Pearl Islands is not. And I was really disappointed. It's so beautiful. And those atolls are absolutely stunning. But all those islands are actually being built up because of global warming and rising sea levels. They're actually man-made, which is really quite depressing, really.
Yeah. Oh, you must, I mean, going to such remote locations, you must see such a contrast between, like you say, that is such a good example between the Maldives and the Pearl Islands, because you must see such a contrast between habitats that have been totally preserved and are intact.
I did it was quite a funny one, I suppose, in China a few years ago, just pre-COVID actually. I spent quite a lot of time, maybe 4 or 5 years, with spending about 3 months each year out in China. And I remember I was working in one of their national parks, and it was just absolutely beautiful, and kind of going through, and like we were doing a big stunt on a waterfall. And I went in, so to make these things safe, you know, sometimes you have to drill bolts into rock so that we can clip ropes in and things, and then we take them out and clean it up afterwards. And then on that one, I went to bolt in or drill into the waterfall, and I realized the whole thing was made of concrete, and the entire national park, like all the water courses, these absolutely beautiful water features that are flowing through, it's all made out of concrete. And it's like the artistry was insane. But I was like, oh my goodness, like what the heck?
That is mental. Do you remember what it was called?
I can't remember. I'll have to
I'll look it up and put it in the show notes. Yeah. How extraordinary. Yeah, and I mean, you said that you were there for 3 months ish, like a year. How much of the year are you spending traveling?
Yeah, it's a good question. So pre-COVID, 10, 11 months of the year, was away. I was literally bouncing from one environment to the next, to the next, next. And it sounds really romantic and glorified, and like it is exciting. But COVID was a really good, I suppose, showed me that it just wasn't that healthy kind of long term to be traveling around like that. So since COVID, or during COVID, and now, I'm trying to work more intelligently and sustainably for sort of my own health, really.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, being on the go that much must really, Well, anyway, we're going to cover loads of it on today's Travel Diaries. We're going to go through a journey today, Megan, through the 7 chapters of your life's Travel Diaries. And what I'm really excited about in particular is to hear about some of these remote and untouched parts of the world that you've been lucky enough to visit, because that's such a rare thing. So yeah, really excited to get started. But first, we're going to go right back to the very beginning. Chapter 1 is your earliest childhood travel memory.
Yes. So I remember this, it was very clearly, I never got to go abroad, and I always wanted to go abroad, which is why I've made a career out of it. But my earliest travel memory was actually when my parents bought a caravan, this tiny little caravan that gets towed behind the car. And I'm one of four. So it's like six people in this tiny little caravan. So I remember like the first summer that we did that, I remember just like this real sense of freedom and excitement and like being nomadic. And for me, it just felt like all the pieces of the puzzle had come together and I felt alive and just felt this is, you know, I had no idea at that time that a career in outdoors or adventure was actually a thing. And I must have been like 7 or 8, I guess. And I just remember just feeling so at home on the road in this like kind of nomadic lifestyle.
Wow.
And
even then
touring Scotland, yeah, in this caravan. Yeah.
Ah, so you went around Scotland with your family. What do you remember, some of the places that you stopped off along the way?
Yeah, we went up to the Isle of Skye. I love seals. I've always loved seals, and going up to the there's a seal sanctuary. I think it's in Oban. I'm guessing it's probably still there. I remember going to that and then going and watching the seals in the wild and just being blown away by like this kind of like beauty in the mountains. My dad was a geologist originally. Did a lot of expeditions, so all our family holidays were always out to go into the mountains to go and look at rocks.
Oh, so I mean, you must have taken after him in many ways.
Yeah, it was mad actually, because I was helping my mum move house. My dad was very unwell for a little while, and it coincided with the time that my parents were moving house. So I was helping my mum box up their books and things, and I found some travel journals that my dad had written. And I started reading these things. I was like, oh my goodness, this is like some crazy like stories, like of his he used to do like a lot of stuff out in Greenland, and this was pre, you know, satellite phones, pre-communication, and like these were really remote, very difficult areas to get to at the time. And there were stories of him studying rocks on islands where like the Inuit would put their huskies onto for the summer. And these things, you know, they're not like nice dogs. Like I've got my dog, my little husky sat behind me. they're not like that. These things are feral. And they'd sit up at night with their like knives fending these creatures off. And then there was a trip where the leader of the trip, I'm not quite sure what had happened, but had obviously lost the plot and was chasing them through the forest with a shotgun and all this stuff. I'm like, okay, well, this is where it comes from.
That spirit of adventure was right there. My goodness, how interesting. And have you gone to any of the places that he went to? Have you like scouted them out for your shows?
I have. Complete coincidence. I was in Iceland last year. I actually did a ski crossing of Iceland in winter, which hasn't really been done before. There's only a few people that have done that, just because it's so, the conditions are so harsh.
So from where to where did you go?
So from the south, from Vik in the south up to the northernmost point. There's a lighthouse up there.
All the way? Skied?
Yeah.
The whole way?
Skied up there, yeah.
How long did that take?
It took us 16 days, and there were three of those days were tent bound because the conditions were so horrendous.
Wow. Yeah. What was it like?
Oh, so Iceland is absolutely magical, but it is so barren. Like the climate there is so influenced. It's a maritime climate, and tend to get like a lot of pressure systems that kind of get stuck there or move through there. So there's very little shelter when you're out there and crossing, and it's the wind and the rain. And what I think catches a lot of people out is that you can be it can be snowing one minute and the next it's torrential rain and everything gets absolutely soaked, and it's so difficult to get into the interior that rescue is very hard. It's very hard to extract anybody, and there's a lot of big holes and things that you can ski off and ski into because the land is so new that you've still got all the kind of the rifts and things that are there.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow, that sounds like an unbelievable trip. Obviously, down in the south in Vik and then up into the centre is a place that is, you know, on the tourist trail. But what's interesting about more towards the north is that I know that recently a flight route has just opened up from the UK where you can fly direct for the first time up further north. Right. So what's it like up there? Because that is much more barren and untouched,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, and the thing is, like, the interior in the winter is covered in snow. You can't access it anyway unless you're going in by ski mobile or on skis. You can't get in there, so there aren't tourists there in the winter, because it's only really the road, the ring road, like, that goes around the outside of the island that's actually accessible.
Right.
So you don't see, so that time of year there's nobody, like, didn't see anybody for the entire time we were out there. But up in the north, it becomes sort of, there's a lot more kind of active sort of volcanic geothermal activity and things that you're going past. So yeah, there was two of us, we had one day where we'd managed to get to these hot springs in the evening, and it was just so nice, like, just having a bath after 2 weeks.
Oh my god, I can imagine. Yeah,
no washing.
Yeah. And those hot springs are just stunning as well, aren't they? Just that connection to nature.
Yes, yeah, it was the power of nature, isn't it? And it makes you feel like so small and insignificant. And because I filmed out in Iceland a fair few times as well. And there we're like very lucky that we get to fly around in helicopters and go into the interior and things by helicopter and go to areas which, you know, there aren't roads and things out to. And just seeing like the sheer, like, as you're flying over it and seeing like the geothermal activity, it's just incredible, like the power of nature and the forces behind it. It makes you feel very small and very weak.
Yeah, totally agree. And so what then, so you were saying how obviously you were inspired by your dad, you felt like this nomadic energy that inspired you when you were in the caravan. How then did you turn that after school into becoming your job? Like, how did you get into it in the first place?
All the way through school, I didn't realise that there was a career outside of academia. Both my parents had worked very hard to get themselves out of the situations that they were in when they were children. And I think being the oldest, it was assumed that I would follow suit.
Right.
But I always found it incredibly difficult to sit still in a classroom within four walls. I was always like, I was always needing to move around. And you know, in hindsight, I now know it's because I have ADD. So,
right. Yeah. Okay.
So actually sitting still is incredibly difficult. And it all makes a lot more sense now.
How interesting that you've then chosen this career path. It's the perfect one for you with that condition, would you say?
It is, absolutely, because one of the symptoms of it is that it's very, very difficult to focus on one thing. And the work that I do within the TV side of things, it's like I'm over the creative side of things, so the storyline, but I'm also in charge of the safety. So I've got helicopters, I've got boats, I've got a film crew, and I know where every single one of those people are and where all the kind of assets all are for the show and what they're doing. And my brain works best over that when I've got this massive moving picture and I'm moving the parts around inside that. So it works very well. So actually, yeah, I now don't see ADD as a real issue, because I know that it's actually very good for the work that I do. It's very helpful.
Yeah.
For that. And it's just unfortunate that a lot of young people do have it, and older people as well, do have it. We're kind of forced into a structured schooling system, which doesn't necessarily cater for people that do have conditions like that.
Yeah. And then what was the big break?
I was involved in the military cadets, and as well as also going off and doing my family holidays with my dad, where we'd go climbing and into the mountains and things. The military cadets had loads of opportunities for adventurous training, which, mm-hmm. So I'd be going off winter climbing in Scotland and whitewater kayaking and doing all these amazing activities that I absolutely loved. And I found myself come alive, and I was in my element, and that drive to push myself to see what I was capable of in those environments just became a real focus. And I've really found myself in that. And so I actually got given a place in Sandhurst to go into the military training.
All right.
Yeah. And but decided I was going to take a year off between that and school, and went off to New Zealand for a year. And I went out on kind of one of these gap year exchange program things, and end up I was placed in a school, and after 2 weeks of photocopying and making tea, I was like, I'm not spending my year doing this sucks. So I bought like a little car for like $200 and drove off around the South Island, I ran into a couple of guys who just started an apprenticeship in an outdoor centre. And they said, well, why don't you give them a shout and see? And amazingly, the woman who was running the outdoor centre was a fellow Brit. And she was like, yeah, we need a girl. Come and join us. So I then spent the rest of the year like training as a raft guide and taking people into the backcountry around New Zealand.
Amazing.
There is a career in this. Wow.
Yes.
Yeah. So the military stuff was put on hold and the rest is history.
And from there to TV, how did that work?
So I suppose like a series of events, and this is why I say oftentimes if you've got like one goal in mind, you're so focused on that goal that you miss out on all these amazing things that happen on the journey to get to that goal. So yeah, I've been in New Zealand. I then came back and did a degree in outdoor studies, which was 3 years of climbing on a student loan.
That sounds like fun to me.
It was amazing. It was a little bit more involved than that, but yeah. Through that, I found my place. I picked up my outdoor qualifications. So I'd got my mountain leader, these are British outdoor qualifications for taking people out. So I'd got my mountain leader, which is like an entry level sort of award that allows you to take people out into the hills of the UK, and sort of climbing instructor awards and things I picked up while I was at university. Mm-hmm. And then I left, I was coming up to graduation, and I ended up getting an apprenticeship in bushcraft, which I spent 3 years doing that, and started doing overseas expeditions with them, they were very sort of anthropological based. So actually going and spending time with indigenous peoples around the world, and then putting the skills that we were learning with them into practice in jungles and deserts and things around the world. And then I ran an outdoor program in a school in Switzerland for 4 years and was expedition leading in the school holidays. And I started leading for another bushcraft company. And they'd just been asked to do the consultancy, survival consultancy, for a little known presenter at the time called Bear Grylls. And it was the second season of his Man vs. Wild, which is the show that made him big. They'd just taken on the consultancy of that, and they needed somebody who could stunt rig. So they invited me along. And
just tell us what stunt rigging is quickly.
So stunt rigging is like designing the ropes challenges that you see on TV.
Right.
Yeah. So rigging that. So decide, like figuring out, like, because there's quite a lot of mathematics involved in like, and forces and things involved in setting up ropes. And at the time, the budgets were so little that a lot of what we were doing was like hiding ropes. So you couldn't see them on camera because they didn't have the budgets to be able to paint them out in the edit.
Oh, interesting. So that was your intro with Bear. And then you've worked with him a ton since.
Yeah, I spent 10 years as part of his core team. So traveling around the world with him. So yeah, we'd just be on the road all the time. I'd be first out, I'd be looking for the locations, setting up the journeys. So the journeys that you'd see on screen, a lot of like the survival stuff that he gets criticized for came from us.
What do you feel most guilty about? Which one?
Well, I think in the early days, because nobody knew how big these things were going to be, and adventure and survival filming has come on a long way since then, partly through the evolution of what we've created. A lot of like the shows that you see now, like the adventure survival shows, are based on what we've developed over the years.
Yeah, the groundwork you guys put in.
Yeah, but in the early days, you know, there was a lot of stuff around killing animals and things to showcase, because we were trying to create the reality of survival scenarios on screen and what you do. We did kill animals for use on screen, which never sat well with me, and I was very, very happy when there was that big pushback from the networks, like particularly the American networks, to stop showcasing that, which has been amazing.
And is that something that you would speak about with Bear? Because obviously he's quite well known for kind of killing and eating like extraordinary things on camera.
Yeah, definitely over the years we had conversations about it, and you know how we should manage that and things. And you know, he then started becoming involved with more conservation charities and things as well. So it's like, well, how do we stay true to the brand and showcase these difficult topics, but how do we also then, you know, bring him in line with the conservation and things. It's very difficult, and he's had like a lot of shit over the years from people because of it. And I think, you know, in a way, I'm actually think it's a good thing, because hopefully it's made people question a little bit more about where the food comes from.
Mm, absolutely. Well, let's pause there and go on to the next chapter of your diaries, Megan. That is chapter 2, the first place that you fell in love with.
Snowdonia. Absolutely. Like Snowdonia, it's my mum's family are from Snowdonia. So we spent every holiday we'd be up here for a week or so exploring and, you know, being in the mountains. And my dad is an incredible storyteller. And he'd always tell us like the stories, like there's some incredible like mythology and things about the local area, like dragons and elves and these things. And he'd always tell us those stories as we're going through. So it always had this real kind of magic quality. And there's something about like the ancient oak forests as you're driving along through the mountains and things. It's just, you can just imagine like the elves and the fairies and things. And it's just something about the place that no matter where I go in the world, I always end up coming back. And during COVID, I bought a house here. So I have an old Welsh farmhouse that's tucked away in the mountains.
Amazing. Yeah. And for people who haven't been to Snowdonia, is it a place that you'd recommend to go on holiday if you're not as adventurous as you are? Is it accessible for them?
Yes, it's very accessible, and there's so much history as well. So you've got all the castles. There was some of the castles were built by the English, some of the castles were built by the Welsh, but there's such a rich history in the area. The beaches are beautiful as well. There's some incredible, huge, like sandy beaches.
And oh, which are your favourites?
So near me, I've got Newbra Beach, which is pretty close by. It's a big forested area, and then you've got these incredible beaches and you're looking back on the mountains. It's absolutely stunning. And then you've got Black Rock Sands, which tends to get really busy in the summer, but you can actually drive onto the sands there. But I definitely recommend that one out of season. Like, don't go in the summer. It's so ridiculously busy.
It's really popular.
Yeah, it's like a massive car park. I don't understand why it's fun to go there in the summer.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. And what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. So chapter three, Megan, is a place where you learnt the most about yourself. Where would you pick for that?
This, I guess, was, it's more about, I suppose, people and the journey. So initially it was New Zealand, and that was the first place that I really got to, I guess, kind of experience the outdoors on my own terms, in the fact of it being a potential career path as well. And it was really enlightening spending time sort of working in this quite remote outdoor center. It was in the Lewis Pass, which is, you know, you've got Hanmer Springs, which is an area where there's hot springs, and there's a few buildings and things there. And then an hour further up was where this outdoor center was, and there was nothing else up there apart from this outdoor center. So spending a summer up there with other people who were instructing, and I just learned so much from them. It was really enlightening, I think, in terms of like setting the stage for the next chapters.
And then your book, Mind of a Survivor, which I can thoroughly recommend, explains really how you relate these lessons that you've learned to people who are not wilderness adventurers, like to the average person. Can you like tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, so Mind of a Survivor it feels like it's written a long time ago now.
But I mean, these are pieces of advice that are timeless.
Yes, absolutely. And I think because I spent so much time in very remote wilderness environments where some of the decisions that I'm making are genuinely life or death, not just for me, but for the people in my care as well. And just constantly seeing the responses that people would have when in these environments was just incredible. It made me realize that we were in those situations where you have to take ownership for your actions, that how powerful it was to actually go out into these environments and see. And it just got me fascinated with, like, you know, what makes a survivalist? Like, what is resilience? Are these traits that can be transferred? And I think in those very raw situations where you can understand where the fear and anxiety is coming from, because you're standing on the edge of a cliff, it's obvious that you're high, there's the potential of falling off. Everyone can kind of resonate or understand where that fear comes from, but can't necessarily understand how it plays out in our everyday lives. And so I have a degree in psychology, which I've done sort of a later date, and I have a fascination with the evolution of the stress response and how that plays out in terms of anxiety and fear and things, and tying that into these environments and then bringing those lessons back into everyday life. It's incredibly powerful, and it's a lot of anxiety and depression and things that we experience in the modern world are symptoms of our evolution. And often when you're in these outdoor sort of wilderness environments, those things disappear because the brain is functioning as it was designed to function.
So can you give me an example?
Yeah, so I get when I was doing a lot more expedition leading, I'd often get clients that would come along who were on medication for anxiety or depression, and they'd come out onto these trips. And I think it was the fact of being, you're part of a team, so you're part of a community where we've become very isolated in everyday life. It's so easy to just do everything online or not see anybody and not really socialize in a, other than kind of in those work interactions, which is often highly competitive and not always that supportive. And so you've got that sort of sense of community, you've got that sense of belonging, you've got a sense of purpose. You know, we're there to survive the jungle or to summit a peak or whatever the goal is. So there's a purpose there of what we're doing. There's a routine every day. You have to take ownership of your actions. You have to get up and you have to, you know, if you're in the jungle, make sure that you look after your feet. So that personal admin is incredibly important. And these things, you know, in modern day life, we don't necessarily need to be doing, and we kind of lose touch with those things. And I found that often people on those trips were then coming off their medication while we're there. And I obviously don't advocate doing this without a medical practitioner being part of that process, but it was just incredible how many people were actually coming off their medication while we were on these trips and having no problems at all.
That's so extraordinary. And yet they were in environments that were probably on paper seemingly more challenging than their homes.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. But I think it's because you can understand where it's coming from. And
yeah,
we've got this, there's two parts of our brains, but to simplify it massively, you've got this incredibly primitive primal part that evolved pre-humanity. All animals have it. It's the limbic system. All animals have it inbuilt into them. So it developed in us pre-language, pre-even us as humans existing. And that part of our brain is purely to keep us safe, and it's incredibly powerful. And the second part of our brain is more like what I kind of think of as like the human brain, which is logic and reasoning. And that developed much, much later, and it takes a lot more energy to run. So whatever the primary kind of driver and the primary thing that's going on in our brains all the time is that scanning the environment, like our senses are constantly scanning the environment, looking for threat and danger all around us. And when we've created this incredible modern world where there's constant stimulation of like noise and visual, you've got cars whizzing around all over the place. It's like that primitive part of the brain, that very animalistic part of the brain is like, you know, it's like a rabbit frozen in the headlights. It's like, ah, what's going on? It can't understand.
Sensory like, overload.
Exactly. Yeah. And then it takes a while for like, you know, the logic and reasoning to step in and go like, it's okay, we've created this. And it's like, we end up being chronically stuck in that sort of that
fight or flight,
freeze response. Yeah. That stress response is like triggered all the time. And that's when, you know, we start getting autoimmune things and digestive problems and health conditions and stress. And we're just not designed to handle stress in the way that we're experiencing it in the modern world.
Yeah, it's so true. Are there any, I mean, I'm just thinking about myself here. I want some of your wisdom. Are there any top level, like major takeaways for my everyday life that could help to get me out of being in a constant fight or flight state, would you say?
Yeah, the mindfulness is like, it's a huge thing. And I think that there's a big, if you see on social media a lot, there's a lot of talk about mental health and all of this stuff and like how adventures like are really good for your mental health. And then there's a lot of people pushing, you know, pictures of, because we've just had the Everest summiting season, it being May, and so you're constantly like being bombarded. If you're kind of into your adventure, you'll be bombarded by all of these pictures of people summiting Everest and doing all of this stuff, and you're like, whoa, maybe that's what I should be doing for my mental health. And that's not the case at all. It's actually very simple things like going out and, for example, if you're in London, like going out on your lunch break, going and sitting in the park and just putting your phone aside and listening to the birds singing, like stimulating your senses, like look around, look at the like little plants that are growing in the cracks in the pavement, and bringing your senses kind of back. So you're triggering the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the part of our nervous system which brings us back into that state of calm and readies us then for stress again. So yeah, going for a walk in the park or going and sitting on a bench in your lunch break is actually far more powerful than going and summiting Everest.
That I also more manageable, certainly for me.
And affordable as well. It's free.
I know we've got a lot more travel diaries chapters to cover, but I also wanted to just briefly mention, I know that in terms of other challenges, in terms of learning about oneself, that you faced Lyme disease earlier in your life, and May is Lyme Disease Awareness Month. And I haven't talked about it on the podcast before, but it's also something that I contracted and have lived with the repercussions of since. So I wondered if we could just have a really quick kind of conversation about it. How did it affect you, and how did you deal with it since?
So I contracted it back in 2007. I had been working up in the Lake District all summer, and I'd been pulling ticks off me, and I didn't really think about it. And then I had a month off where I went out climbing in the Alps, and I remember having one of the classic symptoms of Lyme disease is what's called a bullseye rash. It's like a red ring rash that happens around the bite site of an infected tick. And I developed that, and I knew I knew what it was because I'd been briefing people in when I'd been teaching them. This was, I was teaching bushcraft at the time. I'd been teaching them, and it's like, you know, to be aware of it. So I knew what it was. I just hadn't understood how serious it can be. And I thought, oh, I'll sort it out when I get back to the UK. So I spent the rest of that month with the rash kind of spreading all over my body and having these horrible migraines and just being curled up at the bottom of the crag, like the climbing cliff, in absolute agony with these headaches, which I'd never had migraines or headaches before. And then it would pass and I'd climb. And I basically pushed it into my central nervous system.
Because you hadn't treated it.
Yeah, because I was pushing myself so physically. Hard physically,
yeah,
at the time as well. I just put it into my central nervous system. And then it took about 10 months to get it back out again. So I was on doxycycline, which is an antibiotic, for about 10 months. Nothing just seemed to be out. And I had Bell's palsy, which is like half my face was paralyzed.
These are classic kind of neurological Lyme symptoms if you leave it untreated.
Yeah. And, you know, aching joints. And the worst thing, I think, is brain fog. It's like your brain is so foggy, you can't really concentrate on doing anything. And my doctor at some point was like, you've got to stop, otherwise you're going to kill yourself. Because I found it really hard to stop mountain biking and training and things.
In terms of learning about yourself, I mean, to have the, I think, bravery really to actually stop is pretty hard. You know, that is the hardest thing of all, isn't it? To actually, when your love is to be busy and active, to actually stop and let your body heal.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's the same with, you know, a lot of people, whether you're facing like burnout or Lyme disease, it's very, very difficult to stop. Because for yourself, was this a recent diagnosis?
No. So I was bitten by a tick in my teens, but because there was, and there still is a massive lack of education here in the UK about ticks, their prevalence and the symptoms of Lyme disease. I also left it untreated for in my case, years. And so I've been really left kind of with chronic ailments that have been really hard to shift, and tried a lot of different methods in order to try and address them, and some more successfully than others. But what I really wanted to achieve by us chatting about it is, like, certainly from my point of view, I mean, from your experience, you caught it in the mountains climbing. And I think a lot of people say to me, oh, I thought that you would only get ticks or get Lyme disease if you're in the highlands, in long grass, stalking a deer, or up in the mountains. I mean, for me, I contracted it from my mum's lawn in Surrey. You know, I'm hearing more cases of people Richmond Park, if you're near to London, is like a real hotspot because of the deer community. But it's really becoming far more, ticks are becoming far more widespread in urban areas as well as rural. So to have the knowledge to know what to look out for, to check your children, to check yourself when you've been out in the outdoors, when you come in, just do a quick check, especially in those like sweaty crevices, like your belly button and your armpits. Mine was in my armpit, is just a good practice, I think. Even if you're just out having a picnic on the lawn, it's not something to be scared of, but just to be mindful of.
Yeah.
And if you do have any flu-like type symptoms, because of course some people don't get the bullseye rash, and I think that is also something to be mindful of, and some GPs don't even realize, is that 30% of cases don't have a bullseye rash. But if you do spend some time outdoors and you have some unexplained flu-like symptoms, to go to the doctors and know that antibiotics are the course of treatment.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's also, it's definitely worth mentioning that it is not every tick carries it.
And 100%,
And also, you know, to go outside and enjoy being outside and not be overly scared of these things, but to have the awareness of that these things do exist. And, you know, as Holly said, you know, if you're out in these environments and you come back and you do have achy joints or flu-like symptoms, it is to go and talk to your doctor and tell them that you've been in the outdoors and to get treated. And if you get treated straight away, because I've had friends that have contracted and have been treated straight away and have had no issues at all.
Yes, exactly. The quicker you get a course of antibiotics, the less likely you'll have any long-lasting symptoms.
No.
So it's just about knowing, isn't it? So that you know to speedily get to your doctors. Like my husband got one on his foot during COVID, just in the garden again. You know, he went straight to the doctors and just actually preventatively just got a course of 3 weeks of doxycycline, absolutely fine, no long lasting effects. So yeah, it's just about knowing it. And I've always been interested to share my experience. I've never talked about it on the podcast before, but because you've also been through it and known how challenging it is, yeah, I'm really pleased that we were able to shine some light on it today. So anyway, we digress. Chapter 4, Megan, the big one, your all-time favorite destination. I mean, you have spent the last however many years dotting from place to place. Which has the dearest place in your heart?
So this does evolve, but at the moment it's Mongolia, and it was everything that I'd ever imagined it to be. Mm. It's so wild. Like the history, like Genghis Khan it's an incredibly disturbing story, like most prolific rapist ever. Absolutely horrendous. So I don't really know why we idolize him, but his backstory as a kid and his ability to be able to unite the tribes and bring like vast waves of like humanity underneath one banner is just incredible. And the fact that it came from this incredibly nomadic place just blows my mind. But just the vibes of being out there, a lot of the people still live in traditional gurs, like they're kind of yurt like structures, like tents, and they still live like that throughout the year, very much with their animals, in rhythm with nature. You've got roads around like the main cities, but outside of that it's all like off-road driving or horseback, and there's just something about it. It just feels so healthy and so natural. And I'm sure it's down to that kind of living with the rhythm of nature and the lack of like electricity and things. It's just so untampered with. It's just incredible.
And is it the untouched aspect of it that you found most appealing, that you loved the most? Or was it the landscape or a combination of both, the people? Like, what was it that really resonated with you?
It's a combination of everything. It's a combination of the landscape just being so barren. So I was mountaineering up in the Altai Mountains. We actually went and put up some new climbing routes up there before my clients then arrived. And then I did spend some time, because a lot of the expeditions that I do myself with clients are often to go and spend time with Indigenous peoples. So we were living with the Eagle Masters, which are the Kazakh people who live in the western side of Mongolia next to Kazakhstan. And they still hunt with their golden eagles, which are,
amazing.
It's absolutely incredible. So they will go and take a chick from a nest, from a golden eagle nest, and they take the female chicks because they tend to be bigger and more intelligent than the guys, than the male eagles, and they'll hunt with them. So they'll train them up to hunt, and they're predominantly hunting for fur. So they tend to just hunt in the winter. Yeah. So they're, when the animals that they're hunting, the coats are the thickest, so they provide the most warmth. And a full grown female golden eagle can take out a wolf, like an adult wolf.
That is just mental.
Insane. So,
like, have you ever held one on your arm?
Yes.
Is it almost impossible to hold your arm up?
Well, when you're kind of holding it parallel to sort of the ground at like 90 degrees to the ground, then yes, it is. But they're much lighter than you think. And considering like the strength of these birds to be able to take out, you know, like a wolf. It's incredible, really. And it's not a completely male occupation either. There are female eagle masters as well, which is so cool to see.
Now, I normally say that chapter 4, the all-time favorite destination, is the hardest chapter, but we then move on to chapter 5, your hidden gem, a place that you love that my listeners might not have heard of or know much about. And basically, you've made a career of going from one hidden gem to another. Such an unusual position to be in. What would you be picking?
I think underwater. It's again, going back to kind of, we've touched on like the mental health side of things as well. And I think something for me that's really important is that because I spend so much time on the road and so much time responsible for the lives and the the sort of functionality of sort of million-dollar film shoots. there's a huge amount of pressure on me. So it's finding those places where like your heart like truly sings and you can like be really mindful and present. For me, what is, there's two things that I do. It's like one of them is rock climbing, where it's just like it's just me and the rock and it's very mindful. And the other one is being under the water. So maybe that's spearfishing, but definitely off the coast of the Llyn, the Welsh coast here. There's some incredible little hidden coves and things that I know. So I know whether if the wind's coming from the north, I know that on the south there's going to be some like little hidden coves where the water's going to be clearer and vice versa. So those are my sort of go-to places to kind of escape when, you know, I know that I can start feeling like my own anxiety or exhaustion rising.
How would you spell the place in Wales?
It's the Llyn, so L-L-Y-N, like the Llyn Peninsula.
Llyn.
Yeah, right. So that's the finger that sticks out into, yeah, of Wales. But all along there's like loads of little craggy bits that you can kind of, yeah, hide. And if you've got a van as well, there's some amazing like beach areas that you can like pull into that there's hardly anybody ever there and things.
How interesting though that you didn't pick a place that you've been a jungly TV place, that it's actually a place that's like really near to you.
Yeah, and I think that's really important because I think, you know, these places that if you're thinking about sort of mental health and recharging and things, it's really important that they're accessible.
Mm. Yeah,
whether it's
exactly.
You know, whether it's the end of your garden, or you know, if you don't have a garden, if it's like the local park or, you know, somewhere that's accessible to be able to get to, where you can find the magic, where you can recharge.
So during your career, Megan, you've been bitten by snakes, you've been stung by scorpions, you've been shot at, you've been chased through jungle by an armed drug gang. Chapter 6 is your worst travel experience. What takes a biscuit? I know I'm only naming some of those things as well.
it was a few years ago, and I was working out in China, and yeah, we flew into the airport and got picked up, and the local crew were like saying, you know, it's 2 hours in the bus and we'll be, you know, where we're going to be filming. And we got in the bus and it's like 12 hours later, we're still driving. We've obviously up at like, we're going up about 4,000 meters at the time.
Wow.
It's like a heart. There was three of us from the UK as flying out as consultants for this, for like this adventurous Chinese show. We were there to kind of help them set up an adventure film shoot. And we're now at 4,000 meters, like half the crew and like the Chinese crew in the back have passed out because we're at height from the altitude sickness. And it's like, what on earth are we doing? Where are we going? And then we get to a border and I like realize that we're going into Tibet. And this is an area of Tibet that had only recently opened up to the Chinese, mm-hmm. and it was an area that it turned out that a few weeks before, a load of Buddhist monks had risen up against the Chinese government there and had been shot. And we were there because all the TV programming, everything out there is government controlled, it being communist country. And it was a political statement that we were obviously making, bringing a film crew and then we have some quite major Chinese celebrities coming in to be filmed there.
Oh, and you weren't briefed on this?
No, not at all. No, there was no briefing on that. We ended up being held in the hotel for a couple of weeks with no food and no water.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So there was an exec producer from the UK that flew out and he was able to bring us out a load of, it's called Huel.
That protein drink.
Yeah, yeah. And he brought out a load of that we were then like surviving on for like a couple of weeks. There was some of the Chinese crew were kidnapped at gunpoint and disappeared and were eventually returned. But the whole thing was just crazy.
That's terrifying.
And every time we left the hotel, the Chinese Secret Service, or not the Secret Service, would go through all our stuff, like literally turn our rooms upside down. You could see that they'd hacked into our computers. So it wasn't subtle. You could see them moving stuff around in the computers and things. It was just a really, really bizarre job. But it made me realize like how easy it would be to disappear And to have like an entire film crew just disappear, just feel so small. We got to the point where myself and the other British safety guy that was working with, we'd actually created like an escape plan to get us out of there. That was interesting.
Well, yeah. and then how did it all come to an end?
It was just, things just went back to normal. It was like nothing had happened. It was really,
oh my God, how bizarre.
Really, really bizarre. Yeah, very strange. It was definitely an interesting experience.
Were you applying your survival techniques in those moments?
Yeah, it's like, it's having an awareness. I was having awareness and reality. I think there's a lot of stuff, again, I see on social media and things about this, sort of this movement about at the moment about like positive toxicity and things about, convincing yourself that everything's positive and everything's out. But actually, I think in these situations, you have to have a realism has to be part of that, of like, look, and acceptance of like, okay, this is the situation. This is where we're at. Like, how do we figure out the next movement? Like, what are the potential things that could happen here? And that's a huge part of the job that I do, is in writing risk assessments and risk mitigation. So it's like, I look at a scenario and it'd be like, okay, what's the worst situation? What's the worst that could happen here? Like, what's the reality and how do we minimize the chances and what can we do to overcome it should it happen? And so in that those sorts of situations, it's like, that's the sort of process that you have to go through of like, well, how do we get ourselves out of this? Or how do we make sure that everybody is safe or as comfortable as possible?
How interesting. Honestly, Megan, I could chat to you for the rest of the day. It has been so fascinating and enlightening and really inspiring talking to you. So thank you so much for sharing your travel diaries with us. Our final chapter, chapter 7, is the destination that's at the top of your travel bucket list. Where is left for you to discover that you haven't been to yet?
Oh, well, there's two places that I'd love to go to. One is Antarctica, and the other is Alaska. Crazily, I've never been there. And like, these are things that I've been manifesting for a while. And totally randomly, last week I was asked to lead a guy through Antarctica. And then yesterday, or two days ago, I got asked if I would do a film shoot up in Alaska. So,
oh my God, so, I'm so happy for you. That's amazing.
We'll see if those come off and how those work. But both of those projects, and particularly the Antarctica one as well, because the guy who is just incredible, a disabled guy who would like to go and do crossing in Antarctica, and asked me if I'd help them manage that and do that. So that would just be such an inspiring trip. And he's, whether I go, whether it works out or not, that would be an amazing trip to follow. He's such an incredible guy.
Okay, right. Well, we'll have to follow along. I'll link to your Instagram and I'm sure you'll link to his when it happens. But thank you so much, Megan. Those were your travel diaries.
Thank you.
Oh, I so enjoyed that conversation. What a badass woman Megan is. You can follow Megan on her adventures on Instagram at Megan_Hine. And like I mentioned in the episode, I really enjoyed her book, Mind of a Survivor. Thanks so much for listening today. If you'd like to hear more from the podcast, don't forget to hit subscribe, or if you use Apple Podcasts, to press follow, so that a new episode lands in your podcast app each week. If you want to be the first to find out who's joining me on next week's episode, come and follow me on Instagram. I'd love to hear from you. I'm at Holly Rubenstein, and you'll also find me on Twitter and TikTok, as of a few weeks ago, also at Holly Rubenstein. And if you can't wait until then, remember there's the first 8 seasons to catch up on. That's over 90 episodes to keep you busy there. All the destinations mentioned by my guests are included in the episode show notes here on your podcast app and listed on my website, thetraveldiariespodcast.com. Thanks everyone, and I'll be back next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.